This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're listening to The Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9, a special with me, Doug Pollard. We're talking about HIV criminalisation. Now, so far, we've talked almost entirely about the health end of this business, what the Department of Health does, the people that are involved in the prevention side of things. I wanted to look a little bit now at the police side of the argument and how they see their role. Unfortunately, the Victoria Police declined to take part today. They didn't want to send a spokesman to come into the studio. They didn't want to be interviewed on the phone. They, in the end, after much argument, provided me with a written statement, which is basically about what the legal situation is as far as they're concerned. So I'll read you a little bit of it. And then we'll broaden out the discussion from there. Anyway, the information was provided by the officer in charge of the Victoria Police Sex Crimes Squad, and he says that the relevant legislation relating to the intentional spreading of HIV is in the Crimes Act 1958, as subsequently amended. Section 19A, intentionally and without lawful excuse, causing another person to be infected with HIV, which carries a penalty of 25 years maximum imprisonment. I'd love to know what the lawful excuse might be for that, but I guess that's just the legal terminology. Also available to the police, depending on circumstances, are Section 23, a person who, without lawful excuse, recklessly engages in conduct that places or may place another person in danger of serious injury. That is punishable by up to 5 years imprisonment. And also Section 57, 1 and 2. Part 1 says a person must not, by threats or intimidation, procure a person to take part in an act of sexual penetration. That's 10 years imprisonment. And Part 2, not by any fraudulent means, procure a person to take part in an act of sexual penetration by fraudulent means, 5 years imprisonment. Any criminal investigations relating to the above offences will come to police attention either by referral from the Department of Health or from a direct report from a victim. Now, going back to Section 19A, intentionally spreading HIV, the police need to prove that the infection was intentional. Intention means that the offender must intend the consequences, i.e. the infection of the other party with HIV. So, and I'm sorry for the police language here, mere advertence to the possibility is insufficient. So it's not enough to be aware that you might be transmitting the virus. You must actually intend to transmit the virus. And I guess that's kind of hard to prove. In the case of reckless conduct, conduct is reckless if there is foresight on the part of the accused of the probable consequences of his actions, and he displays indifference as to whether or not those consequences occur. Proving intention relies on taking into consideration the actions of the accused, which can include what was or was not said about their HIV status. In regards to a person representing themselves as being HIV negative when they're not, there is consideration to investigate the offence under Section 57(2), that is, procuring sexual penetration by fraudulent means. So if you tell somebody you're negative in order to have sex with them while you're actually positive, then that can be fraudulent. The officer goes on to say each case will be looked at in its totality and the circumstances surrounding the offence before police decide which is the relevant offence. It is a higher standard of proof to prove intention versus the recklessness required for those other offences. Okay, so that's all the police would say about this. As I say, they wouldn't join us on this programme today. So we're going to try and come at the whole issue of the police mindset from a slightly oblique angle. Joining me in the studio now is Greg Denham. Now, he's a former Victorian Police Senior Sergeant. Since those days, he has worked for the Burnett Institute and also for the Nossal Institute. mainly overseas, often with police forces. I believe I'm right in saying, Greg, that your expertise in relation to the transmission of HIV is more around that via illegal drug use rather than sexual matters. Am I right there?
That's right. It's mainly to do with prevention around transmission of HIV through injecting drug use.
But you can, I think, give us a little bit of an insight into what the police mindset is here. You and I spoke a little bit off air about this, and you said that you're not surprised that they didn't want to talk on a program like this. Can you explain why?
Well, it's a difficult area for police. This issue of, people's, sexual behaviour, and it's an area where I think police sometimes have difficulties. We know, for example, that in terms of HIV transmission, the issue both locally and internationally has been one which has been quite contentious. So I think the police would be very cautious about being seen to be or being in a situation where they were asked to comment or provide, comment on individuals or particular acts which they feel really may not be part of their role in terms of investigation. So I think they would be very cautious about dealing with this issue.
I've been told a few things off the record and unofficially. by people with knowledge of the Victoria Police. One is, I wanted to ask the police in particular about how their liaison with the Department of Health worked. And I was told off the record that there was a certain reluctance by the police to discuss this because, quite frankly, they do believe, as I suggested earlier on when I was talking about the way the health system handles this, they do believe that the model that's used is too lenient on people who are passing the infection around and does leave them at large in the community for too long. Now, this is only, as I say, very deeply off the record, and no one official from the police said this to me, but that is the indication I'm getting. Does that fit with you? Does that sit well with you as what you know about the police mindset, that they would in fact look at it and say, well, there's a crime being committed here, why isn't somebody doing something about it?
I guess that's correct, yes. And, you know, we always used to work on the premise that there's no such thing as an off-the-record statement. So I think you've just confirmed that. So certainly they would have, firmly in their minds, the belief that they need to investigate a complaint, and they would use whatever means necessary to investigate that, and that would include turning their mind to, not putting themselves in a position or the investigation in a position where it may be jeopardised or contaminated in some way. So they would be very much focused on dealing with that particular case, and any additional tasks in terms of a liaison with health where it's not kind of prescribed around policy and procedures in terms of notification, they would rather not go down that task unless it's actually stated that they have to. So they would rather keep it to themselves and deal with it as best they can and deal with the investigation, mindful of the fact that they're dealing with someone who's a victim and someone who will no doubt be saying to them that they have been a victim of crime, and they will have very much that person's needs in their minds when it comes to who they do and don't liaise with. And there will be certain laws or certain requirements in terms of how they deal with that person's confidentiality.
Right. So you could almost say, there's a little picture beginning to come out of the mist here for me. You could almost say that in this situation, the police look first and foremost at the situation from the victim's point of view, and the department, and I'm putting victim in inverted commas here, so don't jump down my throat on these SMSs. I've had a few more of those. And the Department of Health is looking at it from the point of view of the person who is infected already, and also the wider picture of managing the epidemic generally. Michael, would you say that was a reasonable summation?
Well,
I understand, you know, hearing Greg saying that about the police and talking about victims and having dealt with the police myself quite a bit, yet they are very strongly focused on, you know, protecting the public and protecting the victims. So they do see it very much from that angle.
And the whole model is different, as Dr. Carney, I suppose, as was clear from what he said, the whole model's different. The police are focusing on events that happened in the past, and health has a focus which is, which is a more forward-focused approach. So it is a more reactive model necessarily, because they're investigating acts which occurred in the past, and there's only a limited amount of things that they can consider, because they're looking at the commission of a crime, and that's quite a, you know, that's, they're necessarily focused on I suppose what has happened to an individual, what an individual claims has happened to them.
Right.
And they're going through the process of collecting evidence.
Yes.
And that's the thing that's in the front of their minds is to establish whether or not a crime has been committed.
Yeah.
And then establishing a nexus between the offender and the crime. So they have to go through that process of gathering that evidence, and they would not want to necessarily contaminate that process with other matters. And so they may be a little bit reluctant to get involved in something that may actually jeopardise that investigative process.
Right.
So I'm not saying that's necessarily going to mean they're not going to talk to someone in another department about it, but it may mean that they say, well, look, I'm really focused on this case.
It sounds to me as though this is like the nexus of the difficulty between health and the police, if such a difficulty exists, as we suspect there does, that it may actually, this may be the crucial point here. That the difference of approach makes it very difficult for the police to take on board where health are coming from, and vice versa.
My experience again is also, as you say, working internationally in HIV prevention, particularly working with police to look at getting them to support needle and syringe programs and to prevent obviously the spread of HIV. And the police will focus on very much the impact of injecting drug use on the community, and that may mean that they conduct their activities around needle and syringe programs and do things like police crackdowns, etc. And that will drive the problem somewhere else. That will displace the problem somewhere else, causing health problems in other places. And the health people will say, we don't want that to happen. We want you to not do that. We don't want you to crack down on needle and syringe programs, people gathering in the vicinity.
Yeah, because we know where it is, and when we know where it is, we can deal with
it. That's right.
Right, okay.
And I think what the sector actually would like to see is the roles of the various agencies made transparent, and their interactions between each other made transparent. There's a lot of uncertainty at the moment about when the police, for instance, will decide that this is a case that they're going to take forward, and what is the process behind closed doors between the Department of Health and the police in relation to the handling of specific cases. That's something that we actually don't have very much information on.
This is Doug Pollard bringing you a special Rainbow Report on the criminalisation of HIV. For the first hour, we talked with people working in the health and prevention field. We're talking the police angle in this part of the show, and joining us, we have someone who's worked with the police in a number of Southeast Asian countries, Bruce Parnell from the Burnett Institute. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi.
Now, what's your role been in these countries?
We have various roles, but basically what I'll talk about today is our role in providing policy advice to governments or to regional groups like ASEAN. Mm-hmm. And very much there's an Australian culture in the field of development of, we don't go to countries to tell people what to do. We go to help them work out what to do.
Right.
So specifically what I'd like to talk about a bit today, which I think relates to what we've been talking about, is what's going on at the moment in six of the big cities of Southeast Asia and China, with HIV epidemics booming amongst men who have sex with men. And I'll read out some figures now that I think are quite frightening. People were worried in 2003 when epidemiological surveillance in Bangkok found that amongst men who have sex with men, who are pretty visible in Bangkok, they're not hidden, 17.3% had HIV in 2003. No. Well, 2007, that figure's turned into 30%. And the most recent figures from 2010 are 32%. Now,
I thought Thailand were doing quite well with managing the epidemic in the beginning, at least.
Yeah, and that's why people have suddenly gone, hell, what do we do here? Because Thailand's got a very good functioning public health system. They did very well at controlling the epidemic amongst sex workers.
Right.
And what's now happening amongst men who have sex with men, and I think where I'd like to lead from the discussion before is, a lot of the discussion today so far has focused on what happens between two individuals.
Right.
Now, what's now happening in these Asian contexts, and Bangkok's the best example, is to sustain an epidemic, to have an epidemic that suddenly reaches 30%, that's much more than it ever was in Australia amongst gay men, you have to have a critical mass of people who are having sex with one another and who are recently infected. The first few months after someone is infected, their viral load goes up and transmission's far easier.
Right.
After a year or so, hardly any infections happen, even if people are having unsafe sex. Sex is much safer than we've often thought it is.
Is that because they're having treatment?
No, even without treatment, your viral load goes down a bit after the first 6 months.
All right.
You're very infectious in the first few months. Now, what's happening in these six cities in different Asian countries is people are moving from the rural areas to the city. There's a booming new gay culture. So there are internet websites in Ho Chi Minh City, in Jakarta, in Bangkok, in Manila. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's a new sense of it's okay to be gay, and suddenly it's got beyond the control of the public health people. Now, where this relates to police, I was engaged last year as part of the response to this. UN Development Program is responsible for HIV amongst men who have sex with men within the UN family. They're the agency that specialises on that. And the US government, through their USAID program, which is their equivalent to AusAID, was saying, yes, let's do something about this. And the starting point was, let's learn what's going on in these six cities. So Burnett Institute became involved
right.
through that. What I had to do was synthesize lessons learnt in prevention in those six cities. And suddenly we became aware there's a big problem in all these cities with the behavior of police.
Right.
And which brings us back to the stuff. And I suppose what I'd want
what
do, to
when
say,
you say... When you say the behaviour of the police, what are we talking about here? Are we talking... Because gay sex is criminal in some of these countries and not in others, am I right?
Well, actually, we're looking at six cities and it's only illegal in one of them,
right.
which is Manila. In the others, gay sex is legal.
Right.
Most countries have very good laws now about discrimination against men who have sex with men.
So why then are the police a problem?
Because police at a local level don't always understand national strategies. And I think because there's an expectation, as we were talking about before, of police taking a role in public health. And police are not used to doing that. So the worst examples we heard of, in particularly in Jakarta and in Bangkok, police are raiding gay venues and saying, you're distributing condoms, that's proof that sex work's taking place. And
right.
sex work's illegal. Now,
well, that always used to be a problem for women too, didn't it? Because once upon a time, if any woman was found on the street with condoms in yes. her handbags, it was assumed she was a prostitute.
Yeah.
So you're saying we're looking at countries in which this is still the mindset?
Still the mindset, but bizarrely not amongst female sex workers.
Yeah.
So we're talking about gay men and transgender people, and they face enormous discrimination from
right.
police. We're also talking about countries where police don't get paid very much. So if they can fine people, like what they'll do in Bangkok is lock everyone up for the night from a venue, and I've been told that people leave the police station in the order of who's got the most money. And so the foreign tourists are all out of there within an hour by paying $30 or $50.
Right.
The Thai boys are there in the morning.
Are these bribes or fines or what?
Pretty much bribes, I would think. I mean, don't think it would go through their paperwork.
Right.
And but there's also this sense of...
And there's also probably therefore a source of income to be had from the people who run the clubs.
Oh, yes, and there was certainly one of the reports, and I won't say the amount of money involved, but one of the reports I looked at told us how much one of the saunas in Jakarta pays the police per month, and it was a staggering figure.
Right.
I actually told them, take that out of the report, you don't want that all over the newspapers. Now, having said all that, there's also good stuff happening, and Greg can talk a little bit more about the training that people have done for police around harm reduction and needle and syringe. Well, similarly, there's been some good efforts to do training for police. And the reports back from some of these cities are, as I said, younger police, if they can train them while they're learning to be police or soon after, they're responding because partly the culture's changing. Young police are young men, so they understand this is not a threat to our whole culture, whereas the older police are much more likely to be a bit out of control.
So the problem here is not so much one of what the law is or the law getting involved in this HIV business. It's the police themselves and the culture of the police forces in question. And as you say, because they're poorly paid, there is a culture of corruption and bribery in there. That's the problem here, isn't it?
Yeah, and Greg and I are both part of a new initiative that's starting in Melbourne looking at police and public health across a range of public health issues. So there are groups like Nossal Institute, Melbourne University, Burnett, and we've got a couple of people who are ex-Victorian police looking at how we can build on the experience with harm reduction and involve police and public health groups in some of the Asian cities. And we've got support from ASEAN. ASEAN has had one big meeting last year with ministers of health and ministers of police talking together because it's new for them to do that. So it's again, I'd go back to the... It's a problem-solving approach. It's not just about telling young police, change what you're doing. It's about having meetings where police can talk about what's going on from their perspective, what they think their role is, and working it through in a way you would normally do any sort of conflict resolution. And it's almost like the laws are just this thing in the background. It's much more about... And particularly what we're aware of is it's not about getting the top police in the country talking with the top health people. It's about
getting the people
ground,
on the ground.
Getting counsellors and police in the local
Greg,
corner.
I can see
talking.
You sort of nodding and sort of making agreeable noises there. You've experienced some of this, have you?
Oh, certainly. And over the last 10 years or so, there's been concerted efforts through a number of agencies, through the UN, through development money going into Southeast Asia, looking at developing programs for the prevention of HIV through injecting drug use. And I think now the issue of men having sex with men is the issue that's kind of really saying to everybody, this is what we need to look at now. We really need to look at this. And when they started off looking at needle and syringe programs and prevention of HIV amongst sex workers, the sorts of issues that they dealt with are still are being considered now or being made aware in terms of in the gay community.
Right.
So police interaction with various groups within the communities in Southeast Asia has been very much dictated in the past around a social evils belief and very much dictated around government laws, around people's behaviour, very strong social control elements in Southeast
Bruce,
Asia.
Bruce, you mentioned this thing about social evils.
There's even, I mean, Vietnam's the best example. Vietnam
got a ministry of it,
has a ministry of social evils, and social evils are sex work, drug use and sex between men. Well, one of the really good changes that's come out of this initiative that we've been involved in is each of these six cities at a big meeting in Hong Kong late last year prepared an action plan for the next 12 months. And in Vietnam, in Ho Chi Minh City, the Ministry of Health is going to, in their words, are going to instruct the Ministry of Social Evils. So health must be higher up the bureaucracy. Health is going to instruct Ministry of Social Evils in Ho Chi Minh City to visit gay venues and make sure they're distributing condoms. So that's God knows what the human rights implications of that are. But nonetheless, there are... I think it's a good example of what Greg's been talking about, of if you can start by respecting this is the way these countries work,
right,
and not saying that's wrong, you shouldn't have a Ministry of Social Evils, you actually, once you sit at a table and talk with people, find most people are decent. They will change what they're doing. But they won't if we don't give them a chance to talk.
And I think the lesson, if there is a lesson in there for us, bringing this back to Victoria and bringing this back to Australia, Michael, it seems to me that the lesson is that the behaviour of the police can have a serious impact on HIV prevention. Obviously, the way they've been behaving in some places, like in Bangkok, has actually made it more difficult to carry out prevention work. We're not at anything like that stage here.
Sure.
But are the police actually on the ground, as it were, instructed in HIV prevention at all, in the way that that Bruce and Greg have talked about?
No, because I think that the legal issues and the social and health issues here are so radically different in the area of prevention. And, you know, it's an interesting... as the UN has, as own evidence has shown, this problem that we were talking about before in terms of prosecutions for HIV transmission, reckless or intentional, this is a problem of developed wealthy countries. So prosecutions are not occurring in countries that Greg and Bruce are working in. The legal issues and the issues on the ground are totally different. I think that what you say in terms of the role of the police is throughout the world, wherever police take a punitive or heavy-handed regulatory response, the evidence is fairly clear that...
that it makes things worse.
That the health outcomes are made worse by that.
Yeah, because I seem to remember in the early days of the epidemic, there was a great deal of praise for the way Thailand was handling things. And it was only in later years that suddenly, as Bruce pointed out, it all changed. They seemed to kind of lose track of things. And a lot of that seemed to be to do with they suddenly started raiding clubs and closing down clubs and... the other issue we talked about earlier on about driving things away from where they knew it was happening to places where they didn't know where it was happening and making it worse. Bruce?
I think in fairness to some of the public health and police people in these six cities that I've been looking at, the other thing that's been changing is the rapid growth of the gay communities. Hmm. That I don't think 10 years ago they could have predicted that. You know, like Ho Chi Minh City would not have had any sort of gay community just 10 years ago.
Hmm.
Now it's got a website with about 12,000 members. It's just so suddenly it's not like they've ignored the epidemic, but it's like just it's not like they turned their back, I suppose is what I'm saying. It's like
it's
behind their back suddenly there's been this rapid growth of the gay community,
and they haven't modified their own behavior, and they haven't come to terms with it quite quickly enough perhaps.
And there's the whole thing about, and it probably reflects Sydney 30 years ago, Sydney and San Francisco, young people coming from rural areas to the city where they can be anonymous and do whatever they like, and they're doing that before they know about HIV. No one's teaching them about HIV in the schools or in the media in these countries, so they're suddenly having sex before they even know that it's dangerous.
Yes, I'm just chuckling, remembering, you know, in my youth and heading off to Amsterdam, which is probably my equivalent.
London wasn't exciting enough for you.
No, nowhere near. And you're listening to the Rainbow Report special report on HIV criminalisation. Just had a very long message in here from Warren. Thank you very much for your message, Warren. I'm going to read a fair old chunk of it because I think these are important things we need to talk about. Thanks for the programme and the time your panel has given to allow this very open and much needed on-air presentation. I'm not criticising the effort, but I'm wondering where this debate is headed with respect to HIV criminalisation and HIV stigma. I'm wondering if you can comment on the topic of internalised homophobia and internalised HIV homophobia. It seems to me that maybe the most outwardly well-adjusted, functional, out-and-proud person with no issues is slowly but surely being drip-fed with pieces of information which over time have led to undesirable and unhealthy outcomes, the magnitude of which is hugely understated and misunderstood. If the HIV positive person could possibly, through fault or no fault, also be a victim, it seems to me that an unintended outcome of this debate is reinforcing HIV stigma, and that you hold a strong sense of, by hook or by crook, blaming the victim. Given Joy's membership and listener base and the tone of this debate, how can an HIV-positive Joy member or listener be honestly viewed as a whole and functional person, maybe an attractive proposition, or even a potential lover or partner? Is the Joy listener seeing and hearing HIV-positive people as anything other than less than equal and a walking biohazard? Keep up the good work, and thank you for your time. It's much appreciated. I think this is where I have to bring David Menadue in on this one. David, I did say earlier on that I was going to play devil's advocate quite a bit on this and put that side of the argument, and I have done that. You've very much taken the other side. Are we presenting HIV-positive people as a walking biohazard?
Oh, I don't think so. I've tried to make the human dimension of how difficult it is to disclose an issue, both for positive and for negative gay men. Look, the culture is very... it's very easy once you start involving the law to start apportioning blame, and this is where we're much more in favour of the public health model for the reasons we've disclosed today. But I think a lot of people don't realise that actually the law, the public health law, has a number of clauses in it that might interest negative gay men. One is a person at risk of contracting an infectious disease should take all reasonable precautions to avoid contracting the infectious disease. That's actually a clause in the law that states if you're a gay man, for instance, at high risk of possibly picking up HIV through casual sex, it's actually your responsibility through law to not put yourself at risk. So I think there's those issues too, but in terms of the stigma and what we're trying to do about it, we're, you know, nationally about to produce a campaign called Fear Less, Live More, which is looking at online interactions and certainly messages in the gay newspapers and so forth about trying to change people's perception of HIV-positive people. When people don't talk about HIV, and I think it's become more invisible as so many of us look well now and so people don't assume they're talking to a HIV-positive people. When that happens, exactly what Warren spoke about then, the stigma is much more intense. When you actually come out and say, I'm a HIV-positive person, they think, oh, I don't know any positive people. You know, this is a real shock. When the truth is, they know heaps and the people are keeping quiet.
That's kind of ironic, really, given that, you know, gay people are always being encouraged to come out as gay in order to help lessen the stigma that we suffer from society in general. And as a strategy, it's been, I think one would have to say, pretty successful down the years. Is this the case now that HIV-positive people have to follow the same and come out too?
Well, we have to make it safe for them to do so. And, you know, I personally have found it much easier to do that because I'm a member of PLWHA Victoria and the AIDS Council. I've surrounded myself with people who give me support when that happens, but a lot of people don't get that, and a lot of people aren't prepared to, you know, venture near support groups or talk to other positive people. They're totally isolated, and, you know, unfortunately that's where their lives spiral into sort of drug and alcohol, trying to cope, or, you know, becoming such a secretive world that the thought of someone ever discovering their status becomes a nightmare. And yeah, we've got to change that culture, but how you do that and how you make an easier environment for us all to be able to say, well, he's HIV positive, so what? Rather than this huge secrecy and this huge stigma that still exists. We know it from the, you know, the research, the amount of negative comments that people with HIV get from the gay community, but also, I have to say, even the medical profession in some areas still needs to improve, and people with HIV have been discriminated against in that area as well.
Thanks, David. And thanks for your question, Warren. I think it was very well worth having a very quick look at those issues. We're getting towards the end of our time. I never thought I'd feel like I was running out of time after 2 hours talking about this. But I am. But I want to come back to Michael at this point. Now, we've talked about the relationship between Victoria Police and the Department of Health. And we've talked about this very difficult kind of nexus that happens that exists, where, you know, is a case going to be dealt with by the police? Is it going to be dealt with by health? At which point is it handed from one to the other? How good are the two sides at keeping each other informed? Now, it's my understanding that there is, in fact, a document that governs how this is all supposed to happen. For want of a better term, I'm going to call it a memorandum of understanding, which came about as a result of the Michael Neal case, because that was kind of rather badly botched, the communication between the two sides there. So a memorandum of understanding came into existence between the police and the Department of Health as to how these issues would be managed and who would do what, when, where, why and how. Unfortunately, we're not allowed to see this document. We're not allowed to know what this policy or set of policies is. I did ask around, and I was told again off the record, you will never see it. No one except the police and the Department of Health have any right to see it, and that is because it is, quote, a living document, and whatever that might mean. And I think we might profitably look at that. Michael, have you had any success in having a look at this memorandum of understanding? Do you know what's in it?
No, and my understanding, you know, is the same as yours, Doug, is that it's not a public document. It's not openly available. So,
because I was told I could glean all I needed to know about it by looking at the guidelines that are on the website.
Well, I don't. The guidelines will tell you very well how. How Dr. Carney's team handles people.
Yes, but it says nothing about the nexus with the police.
So it doesn't actually... No, it doesn't go into how cases between the two agencies will be handled. And I think as a minimum we need to see that document, the MOU, and we need to, from there, go forward and argue for a set of guidelines, enforceable guidelines, which would...
Why do you think we need this document to be publicly available, to be transparent?
Because there is so much uncertainty about how cases are handled. So, you know, you can be... we know that people can be dealt with under both systems. So what does that mean if someone's being handled by the health department and they're going through the health department processes, but they're also under investigation by Victoria Police? Does that... there's no certainty around that process. We don't know anything that's publicly available about how the discussion around the cases proceeds.
And does this make your job harder?
Well, it does, because we have a lot of anxiety in the community about behaviours, about what people are doing. There's a lot of anxiety about the role of the criminal law, whether people are potentially engaging in an act that could be construed as criminal. There's a lot of uncertainty about how the two departments are working together, indeed whether they are, and exactly what the role of the police is. And what we really need is, I think, is guidelines similar to exist in the United Kingdom, whereby people will be prosecuted under certain circumstances, either guidelines that the police have to follow or guidelines that the prosecution agency has to follow, which lays out all of these things that we're currently uncertain about. You know, what is an appropriate, what will the law regard as an appropriate level of risk, or what is the role of scientific evidence? Scientific evidence around the source of transmission be led? What is...
Yes. Because that's one issue we have no chance to go into today, which is it is actually quite difficult to track down exactly who infected who and when and where.
Sure.
By chasing down the different strains of HIV. And again, I invited a couple of people to come and talk about that, and they all declined. Look, we are going to have to wrap this up, I'm afraid. If I could sum up what we've talked about today, I think we still have a long way to go, not just in prevention work, but in reducing the stigma for HIV-positive people, and thereby reducing the amount of rejection and hatred they suffer, which in turn will encourage them to be more open and in turn will hopefully help drive the rates down, because there are signs that it's going back up again under some circumstances, and that's the big worry. I want to say thank you to all my guests today. Michael Williams, the president of the AC, David Menadue, long-time HIV survivor and formerly of PLWHA Victoria, now with the VAC. Bruce Parnell from the Burnett Institute, and Greg Denham, the former police senior sergeant who's also worked with the Burnett Institute and also the Nottle Institute. Also joining us on the phone, we had John Carney, the chief health officer for the state of Victoria, and Dr. Jim Hyde, the director of public health in charge of prevention from the Victorian Department of Human Services. You've been listening to a special edition of the Rainbow Report on Joy 94.9. Coming up next, we've got Touch of Pink with Dennis and Dick. My name is Doug Pollard, and I'll be back on air in a new regular time slot starting in April. Everybody up there in Daleswood at Chillout, have a great weekend. Congratulations on raising $29,000 at your slowest lunch for the Alana and Madeline Foundation Anti-Cyber Bullying Initiative. And goodbye to you, and thanks for listening.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.